Okay, so welcome back to the industry vertical and embedded crypto session here, and this session will go till 12:25, and the lunch break will be served in the exhibit area in room 2415. One message I got from the organization is that the CMUF website is currently down, and they are expecting that this website will be up tomorrow afternoon. And yeah, let's start the session, and I will hand over to Lawrence and Carol with a presentation about crypto modules.
Good morning. It's lovely to be back in Ottawa for myself. I've spent most of my security career here. Carol is with EWA Canada. I've spent the last 4 years at the University of Saskatchewan, and you'll find that colors both my research as I'm affiliated with both the business and computer science department, as well as my day job that effectively of CISO of the university. So I can tell you what the current crop of 17-year-olds are demanding. And I use the word demanding. I'm also going to focus on what I call a fundamental. I can't stand. Everyone hear me okay so I can wander?
At least.
They want me to tape. I hate this. hate podiums. It's good to know. What I'm going to talk to you about today is a fundamental change that's actually happened in society and how it's actually going to have major ramifications for the security industry, and effectively come down to a recommendation that the only real solution is cryptography to these many problems. The other thing we're going to emphasize is the fact that we're having a fundamental shift from confidentiality to integrity, and I want to talk about that in our terms of primitives. So this is meant to be more of the societal introduction for the change, because most of us security professionals are heads down and don't realize they just didn't move our cheese. They changed its flavor, shape, and color and forgot to tell us in the process. And I see that every year when I run into a freshman class and what they're demanding. And I'll give you a little example of that. Every August, the university brings in the scholars of Saskatchewan to the university to try to entice them to come to U of S. I got asked last year by a very bright young lady, how come we didn't have two-factor authentication? This is a 17-year-old. This is what they're demanding. This is part of their selection, both of university and employer. And I want to get into that. And this is the major change. I didn't put the U of S blurb in here, maybe I should have. It's one of the U15 top research, medical, and doctoral universities in Canada. We currently have 22,500 full-time equivalents. The IT department is amazing. We have 10 petabytes of online storage, 200 gigabit per second separate internet points of presence, 2,400 access points, 2 virtualized cloud environments, and some numbers here that really shock. We have 16,000 plus mobile users a day, each with up to about 1.9 devices per user. So it's roughly 36,000 mobile devices. In my area, I manage an identity management system for 80,000 active users. So I want to put that in perspective, and that's 80,000 single sign-on across the campus. What we're seeing right now, that we have massive proliferation of mobile, cloud, and Internet of Things technologies. They're real, they're out there, and they're present, and we may not know it. Smart homes, smart automobiles are here today. I've got a major problem. All these people that drive a certain model car that has a built-in access point are beaconing out in the parking lot, and suddenly we're having something called tragedy of the commons. And there are any economists in the room, they'll be familiar with this. It's about mid-1700s that was looked at, and the whole theory was a bunch of cooperating people put their cows in the common pasture, you will destroy the pasture. And we're seeing that in lecture halls like this. Because if you've got every student with 2 devices or 3, you can saturate. We're also suffering from something, I'll use the word suffering, called deperimeterization, because perimeter-based security is dead. And I'll walk you through, that is one of the fundamental things I want to talk about today, and you'll understand why cryptography is so important. Carol will be providing color commentary and making sure I remain accurate. which I really appreciate. I also want to go back to a little bit, I can't help this. I have a lot of business training and I tend to drift back to this. Anyone that was here during the dot-com boom would have encountered something called the technology disruptors. The graphic is kind of interesting, the evolution that we've gotten to in that time frame to 140 characters or less. But it's defined as a thing that happens that basically shakes up the industry. Actually, it really shakes up society. And as security practitioners, it's really important to look at that. We're actually trying to put together a team and we're trying to find an anthropologist that wants to work on security issues, because we're beginning to believe that there's some fundamental issues that we are not dealing with. And one of the reasons is because we're not looking at the sociology impacts of it. We're starting to call it in the academic community, we're living in what's called the fourth industrial revolution. And you're saying, but I'm here to learn about crypto. Well, this is important to realize that we're going through this inflection point. You know, it all started in 1784 with the steam engine. 1870, we got the first mass production. 1969, at the end of the Apollo program, we got the trickle-down effect of all that IT and electronics that was developed for it. And in 2016, you got cyber-physical systems, Internet of Things, mobile and cloud computing. And we see it at the university. This is actually based on a paper that was in The Economist. We are in the fourth industrial revolution and we're going through major societal change. And if security doesn't realize that the world has changed, we're going to be made even more obsolete. We were talking before the presentation about the average individual, young person, doesn't care about confidentiality. They're about integrity. And every time I talk to some people about crypto, they think confidentiality. And I'm going to say, nah, it's not going to matter anymore. It's integrity. It's authentication, authorization. And we'll talk a bit about that. Evidence of the disruption. This is the best business proof. You realize that of all those firms up there, none of them has any real assets. Largest hotelier owns no real estate. Largest retailer has no inventory. Facebook, largest media producer, again, creates no content. Uber, the world's largest taxi company, owns no vehicles. It's all about service delivery. And when you think about the service delivery, what's key to it? Authorization and authentication and identification of the endpoints. The actual content, you can argue about whether or not it requires confidentiality, and that's a separate issue. There is a red herring that people go after privacy. And you know what? Privacy is one of those things that people like to hide behind it. However, you can eliminate it as an issue with suitable synonymous identification. But we're not yet willing to do that. And we're trying to come up with, we seem to hide behind it. And in reality, you're not increasing your privacy because we actually have less with our older systems, but that's another presentation. And I want to spend some time talking about this. Anyone have a Nest at home? A few. How about, since we're in Canada, I got to ask, how many got the Bud Light hockey goal lamp? This is my first encounter of Internet of Things in the university in dorms room in professor's office. You program with your cell phone to your NHL team, and when they score, it blinks and plays the victory song. Lots of traffic during the playoffs. It's amazing. Uses a little compact flash controller chip with built-in Wi-Fi and Bluetooth to talk to your cell phone. Amazing. Down the lower cap is the Vera system, which is for home automation control. Anyone playing in that space? Now, this is interesting. This is a low-cost device, less than $100. You have to put the sensors in the home. And my property in Saskatoon yesterday, a colleague opened the door, checked on the mail, and I got a nice little email and a text saying door had been opened and picture available. And she waved. It's here. And then I'm going to finish off on one that scared me. That's a new hospital pain pump. It's designed to eliminate errors by medical staff. So it reads a barcode and you type in the patient's name and it figures out how to meter pain medication. When they got delivered, there were 1,400 security vulnerabilities in them, and it used Telnet and unsecured HTTP to reach back for its database updates. The reaction from the medical community was, oh, it's FDA approved. Okay, go read up on the FDA approval process and see if you can find the word security or cryptography anywhere in the document. You can't. My challenge for anyone from NIST around here is, how come we haven't seen yet guidance on security for network-enabled medical devices? So you see, I'm starting to set this environment where we, on the hard part of security, cryptography, can start to claim and deliver solutions. The other thing that's happening here is the number of stakeholders are multiplying. We are ending up having multiple carriers we're dealing with. We have lots of third parties that are involved with lots of third-party licenses. I went back to school and only finished 2 years ago, and I had a real interesting problem. So I had a consulting business on the side, yet my university provided me a student package that said I couldn't use for commercial purposes. But yet I was working as a consultant. The temptation was there, but it would be a violation of license. And this is the type of environment we're finding ourselves with third-party licensing. We've got the problem at the university right now. We're changing how we engage our medical clinicians in the School of Medicine. They're not going to be any employees any longer. They got very upset at me when I told them they couldn't use our Microsoft licensed equipment anymore. So that's understanding that. We have a proliferation of apps. Is there an app for that? I mean, that's literally it. And at least we have three things going on. You know, we have work, home, and perhaps school, or other environments. And we have to do this. So this creates what is called a multidimensional risk problem. Now, one thing, I'm a bit of a security purist. I've been in this business for almost 30 years. And I really don't like when we talk about risk without backing up and understanding what the underlying, where it comes from. And the fact it is, in this case, it's not a technology problem. It is not a business problem. It's a societal problem. Risk involves the list that's there. I'm not going to go through it. But what we're getting to, we're moving to something called an information problem. A friend of mine, Jesse Horn, talks about who owns things, where the authority on the internet comes from. How come the Kardashians have so much authority? He calls it cognitive authority. Interesting use of the word. But in having lunch with him, what we're really starting to get to now is about information authority. How do you know that information that you get, A, is trustworthy, and B, hasn't been modified? Now, let me introduce where cryptography matters. I'm going to say fast forward by 10 years. I want to use a U.S. example. So how many folks from south of the border are here? Okay, good. They'll understand this, and I think the Canadians will, and I'll explain for everyone else. In this science fiction short story, the U.S. Supreme Court decides to make their authoritative record of all their decisions an electronic one. The hacker goes in and changes Roe versus Wade. So suddenly, abortions are now illegal. Because they didn't put cryptographic safeguards, they have to accept that as the ruling. It's a scary short story. But we're all in cryptography. We all understand that. So think of the ramification. And I want you to think about that, because that, again, is an example of the information evolution and where cryptography is going to have to be very, very, very fundamental to it. So what is really happening here is that we're eradicating boundaries. We traditionally rely upon in our defense postures in a sometimes called a type of defense in depth where we build boundaries. You know, if you think about it, think about a U.S. cavalry fort out in the U.S. plains. You know, poles on end sharpened, a single perimeter. If you're inside, if you're good, if you're bad, you're outside. And you put a door up, and that's how we built our networks. We had the internet, great unwashed, the intranet, we put a demilitarized zone, and, well, if we trusted you, we put you on our extranet, and that's what we lived with. That's gone. And there was a group in the UK, and for those people that have a bit of knowledge of the Old Testament, they called themselves the Jericho group. Jericho was the walls that were knocked down by blowing trumpets, and they predicted in the 2000s that that's what was going to happen. Well, they stopped doing their work in 2007, 2008, but now in 2016 we're living the nightmare. There are no walls anymore. I let 16,000 mobile users onto campus, and I really don't want to know where they were the night before with their device. And I know what comes on those devices because our system, like, by the way, give you an idea of scope, 500 compromised email accounts a month is a good month. See, there's no absolute security. In my case, it's keeping the fire down to a controllable point of view. We have a SIM with a full-time analyst on board, handling and triaging what we detect every day. So we are kind of a microcosm of society. So that's called deperimeterization from the Jericho Group. Internet of Technology now makes that really bad. It originally started with mobile and cloud. The boundaries don't all exist. It is deperimeterized. I love telling vendors, no, we don't have an edge firewall. And their jaw drops. No, we do not have an edge firewall. We have a packet forwarding router that keeps out some traffic, and we do some traffic shaping. Our firewalls are actually back in front of our two large data centers. See, it's a shift in thing. And that's the mark of the societal disruption. Like, one of the comments I want to make to the organizers here, I can't believe you don't have free Wi-Fi. You know, and that's just not me. That's an expectation. That's an example. You know, you want that service. This is the demand and push that's coming. And so it's not just about who is accessing the information. It's becoming who, where, how, and with what. Because sometimes it's my university phone, sometimes it's my laptop. For a while there, I used to carry two phones and I gave up on it because it's just too much to worry about to maintain. But a lot of folks do that. That's trying to take that perimeter model and push it out to the device. And that's broken. It's not going to work. I mean, it's like security is only confidentiality. And I've got that typical shocked look from security people when I give this presentation, so I'm enjoying it. That comes into something else that we're toying with called the context of use. That's where you are. So think about this. At my desk, in my office at the university, I have full access to the university's identity and access management system for 80,000 users, which means I could change identities, do whatever I want. Should I have that same access from here over the internet? Should I have the same access on the airplane when I was flying out here from Saskatchewan? That's context of use. Am I on a university laptop? No, I'm on a personal laptop. I'm a tablet. Asking that question during the authentication and authorization piece. But how are you going to, once you authenticate, how are you going to authorize? And we're getting down to a cryptographic driven set of primitives. And this gets back to the whole idea of the role of cryptographic modules, where we're going. To be effective for the Internet of Things, InfoSec has to evolve. It's got to be information and device centric. That means it's got to be proactively monitored, continuously compliant. Now, I'm responsible for PCI DSS compliance at the university, and we can talk over a good dark beer about what that really means, but I mean, it's a big load. You can't just do it once a year. You have to be continually. Every night at the university, we chant for normal vulnerabilities. We make sure we basically do SCAP every night now, Security Content Automation Protocol out of NIST. We've built our own system. That's the only way we can keep up with it. That's for 1,500 virtual terminals, 5,000 desktops. The rest, we don't worry about, but that's, you know, the core. Application and data firewalls. We're doing adaptive authentication. Okay, where is Lawrence? Oh, that's an Internet of Things device. Is it where it should be? I got a great Internet of Things device, a chick incubator. Yes, for hatching chick eggs. If it fails, we could lose 4 or 5 years worth of research work if the chickens die. That, when it showed up, had no security, yet was supposed to plug into the internet and talk to a smartphone. And that's what I'm trying to start to get to. How do we secure things like that? We are a veterinary medical school. We're putting remote cameras in to monitor the horses during foaling season. You know, because having two graduate DVMs on duty, they may not get to the right place at the right time and quickly enough. And I didn't realize that some of these horses are worth $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. So you see, it's that reality of where it's being used. So when that all comes down to it, the best solution to it, I'll challenge, is to authenticate and authorize the IoT device, protect the information, and this should be delivered by a validated cryptographic module. The new perimeter is the information boundary, and I'm going to argue with the solution is cryptography, which means we somehow have to get a cryptographic service out to every Internet of Things. I like the cryptographic as a service presentation, but I'm beginning to wonder, because it is a cloud service, and this is a change I'll probably make this presentation, we're probably looking at a hybrid service. Some will be done on the module, some will be done on the cloud, and then we'll have to appropriately do it. As Carol and I were discussing, that means the secure communications link between the IoT device and the crypto, the cloud service becomes very, very critical. But I also have a battery and processor load problem that I'm going to have to split between the two. So I made a note, maybe some research grant out there to look at that. But that's the thing, you know, how we balance that load from the device and the cloud. Because what really worries me is what happens when you can't get to the cloud. And if people think I'm dreaming something up, go read what happened to the poor residents out on the eastern coast of New York State after Superstorm Sandy. I'm not going to go into the details, but some people there have never got their phone back. They didn't put the copper wire back to the house. They put a little permanent cell phone in the basement that they dial in a phone, but it goes out via cell link. There are companies that went out of business because they didn't get access to their data in the cloud because it was all on over internet. So something to take a look at. So this is a phenomenal IoT reference architecture. It's from these folks, WSO2.com. And I thought this was perhaps the simplest, best representation of what actually goes in an Internet of Things device. And it's actually quite complicated. I was actually surprised when I started looking at this. You know, we have a device manager. There's entity and access management, the actual devices. We've got evolving special protocols. We have event processing analytics. There's usually a dashboard, a web portal, and an API management. Anyone has the Fitbit, Fitbit craze gotten to this group? Yeah, a lot of nods. Yeah. How many have the home scale that goes with it? That, to me, is probably the best example of this, how you control it with your smartphone, bind it to your home network, bind it to your the application in the cloud. So you get to do the horrible thing every morning when you go to bed, you can weigh yourself, you know, it's, and track it. You know, it's where we're at. Any diabetics, one of the new meters now is Bluetooth. So every time you check your, do your blood sugar testing, it gets logged for you. So you don't have to do that anymore. So when we're talking about surveillance, I'm going, wow, think about all this data. But what's the trade-off? What's really the risk? So anyway, this diagram isn't bad, but I changed it. Carol and I added the embedded cryptographic module down below, which is missing. There has to be a module in this stack that provides the trusted services to perhaps an untrusted, low-cost IoT platform. We were talking about time to market and about the how many days it takes to get to market. The key to that is to build a crypto module that's reusable. I don't have it in here, but if you want to go read a book that's phenomenal, it's called The Power of Product Platforms. And if you can make your way through talking about Black and Decker drills, you can understand the value of a validated module that is plugged into that IoT device. But that has to talk back to the crypto as a service in the cloud, because we can't put all the advanced mathematical computations or storage in the cloud. However, we need to be able to do things at the module level. Now, I'm going to talk about the fact that we probably don't need confidentiality in mode IoT things. I really don't care if my scale encrypts my weight. Some people may, I don't care. I just want to make sure it's my scale reporting my weight. My Nest thermostat, I want to make sure it's my remote control that's changing the temperature. Because in Saskatchewan, when it's minus 40, that's the same in Celsius Fahrenheit, I want to make sure that it hasn't been turned off. So this is what it comes down to, how to do that. And this is this whole idea of a hybrid solution with an embedded cryptographic module with minimum functionality in the device that's been validated independently, that perhaps does more authentication and data integrity than it does confidentiality. Now, if we get ourselves out of those modes and remove those cipher implementations, we start getting into a very, very specific, customized piece of reusable architecture. And if I remember my export control dual use thing is once we take out data confidentiality out of it, we're not constrained as much, if I remember correctly, under the Wassenaar agreement. And I stand to be corrected. And then we put the hard stuff up in the cloud, things that require computational effort, cryptographic binding, or other functionality. So that's kind of the hybrid split we're looking at. So people will say, and myself included, what's the reference implementation? I got to thank the FBI for suing Apple for access to the i6, because they actually disclosed a lot of things that they hadn't disclosed. This is the actually reference architecture out of an i6. It's available on the Apple website if you go search for it. How many people remember an Orange Book in the room? This is the legendary reference monitor. And those that don't, shame on you. You should read it. In the kernel, they have a secure enclave, which is actually separate, which talks to a separate crypto engine, which you're pulled off into a separate processor. The problem is the FBI could get access to the main processor, but they couldn't get access to this small crypto security reference monitor that was actually enforcing mandatory access control. And if you've read, unfortunately like me, was forced to read the Orange Book and whatever, the Red Book for the network implementation and all that stuff all so long ago, it came back. That's what Apple did. And it just freaked me out when I realized what it was an example of. And it's a tremendous example. So the secure enclave is built on a crypto engine. Now, Apple doesn't disclose much, so I've had to interpolate on what the functionality is. But then I found out that you can't use a non-Apple fingerprint scanner because it's cryptographically bound to this. So there's a lot of brilliance going on in here, but it's actually doing a lot of the things that I didn't realize we could be able to do. Also does very, very effective application sandboxes. So it's probably, there's a bit of security by obscurity here, and this is a bit of my kind of trying to figure out what's going on. But it really demonstrates to me the type of model that you can take and get into a mass-produced device, so much so that if you mistype your password 10 times, it bricks the phone. So we have a reference implementation, and for those people that are big on standards, first reference implementation is really, really important, although Apple's not claiming it to be. It has all the earmarks of that. So I wanted to, and just Google it if you got some time to read, because there's an awful lot been disclosed as a result of the court case. So this gets us in to what some of the primitives we're going to have to see. I really want to emphasize this is more about integrity and availability than confidentiality, which totally changes the cryptographic module functionality. I was shocked. I run a home automation system, and I looked at my home firewall and realized how many connections to the cloud and Akamai web servers and Adobe web servers it was making. Kind of scary because there is cameras in the house, so you know, hooked up to it. But what got me, what made me comfortable, I had to have some diagnostics done. The help agent directed me to this page. And I generated a unique SSH key for him to remote in. So I asked, do you have a security policy? Oh, yeah, it's on the website. Go here. I actually was pretty impressed. A company, that's Vera, that actually had thought about this. But the other thing I began to realize is that authentication needs to be bidirectional. We have to authenticate from the device to the cloud, but the cloud has to authenticate itself to the device. I don't want anyone talking to my thermostat but Nest. Finally, trusted software distribution. This is going to be a major issue because bricking an Internet of Things thing is horrible. And I don't know if people realize that there was a lamp a few years ago that had embedded Linux that actually had a vulnerability injected that you couldn't update. So could you imagine coming home with a vulnerability notice that all those expensive lamps you've now put in your house for remote control purposes have to be removed because people can do what's called a sideways attack. You go in, compromise the lamp, go sideways. And that is what we're seeing in the medical community, by the way. There's a couple of different trademark names for it, but it's a something jack. And the idea is you look for a soft Internet of Thing device, you compromise it, you reload it, and then you go sideways. And it's very widespread because, again, they meet FDA approval, but there's no cryptography or information security in those devices. So the cryptographic module primitives that I'm going to recommend that need to go in here, and for all those fellow people that are old enough to remember the red book and orange book, you'll recognize these. Mandatory access control has to be present. We need to have cryptographic binding between the label to the asset. In mandatory access control, the key is we label our information. We assign a sensitivity, but it has to be cryptographically bound to the metadata. The reference monitors we talked about earlier, and the best way to look about that, remember we talked about the castle model, this is kind of the guard at the gate saying, do you have the right credentials to get in? Yes, you do. Yeah, you can go to that asset. And only if they match or they meet policy, and I'm really going to make people feel old, yes, I'm talking Bell LaPadula. User or the malware cannot change the metadata with a label attached or the subvert the enforcement of access. That's what Apple has done. And that's kind of the level of you cannot violate it no matter what you do. And that, you know, we cryptographically bound labels, cryptographically signed code, cryptographically signed information. Again, it's integrity, it's not confidentiality. Object reuse is another big issue. One great way to attack a device specifically is to look at what's in RAM. Well, just encrypt it all before it goes to RAM. This is confidentiality, but it's very important. Follow-on process cannot read the previous data stored, and that means objects can be freely reused without data leakage. The other one that I have to add in here, and in full disclosure, I patented a long time ago, and that's the come from. For those people that have a computer science background, remember you could use a go to when you have a come from? A come from is a primitive where a routine says, are you authorized to call me? Do you have the right digital signature? Yes, you can call me. And if we did that one thing, we'd shut down most malware in a few minutes because they wouldn't necessarily have the right cryptographic credential. So that's the other thing, is to get the security into the devices, building on a cryptographic building block is actually straightforward. It's actually using some of this, you know, ancient research back from the late 70s, early 80s, to put security primitives in a device. You'll notice something. There will be, if the cryptographic module is done properly, you can remove the need to have highly trustworthy code by putting certain controls in the OS. You can. There was work done in Australia about 4 years ago on a secure hypervisor for mobile phones. They actually were looking at an EAL6 evaluation till I believe Lockheed bought them and it kind of went away. But they were onto something. Build the underlying low level, build it really well, and what sits on top of it is less of a problem. Interesting areas that further research needs to be done. But, you know, we're talking crypto modules here this week. You can see these type of features. And let me go back. Nope, didn't do that right. Sorry. Oh. Anyway, how do I get to go backwards? There we go. You know, trusted software distribution has to be done properly. We got to do mandatory access control, provide object reuse. And if you go back to that lovely chart of B2 level systems from the Orange Book, and if we pick off the right ones, we can basically build very secure Internet of Things. And I want to finish up with another borrowing of technology. I was fortunate to be at Nortel back around 2000 when we put together with Cisco and a few other large telco suppliers a method to secure the VoIP and multimedia infrastructure that was being deployed. In that environment, we modeled it as three layers. Management, signaling, and media. We secured management first. Because if I can still manage my network, I can take care of any threat. That's what we need to apply to the Internet of Things. Signaling is now next, i.e. the communication between the IoT and the controlling device. Lastly, that you secured is media, And believe me, we never did voice level security. It wasn't worth it. People didn't want it. They wanted media and signaling. So this is the functionality we have to have in the crypto module. To support that, it needs to be primitive. It needs to be a hybrid architecture between the device and the cloud. And it has to be validated. And yeah, dust off your copy of the Orange Book and the Red Book and look at the primitives and look at the definitions of B2. And you'll see how you can build a trusted system. Now, excuse the title of it, there's a group of us at RSA that get together on Friday called the Old Farts Club. You got to have at least 25 years in information security. There is a system built on that model that's been on the internet since about 1997 that has never been hacked at Princeton. So it does work. It just takes the time to look at it. Anyway, I don't know if Carol has anything to add. She's actually the brains behind the crypto here, so.
Not really.
Okay.
Oh. Sorry, excuse me.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to add, I mean, I think Lawrence has covered most of it, is that thinking about the Internet of Things, right now we're communicating, there's a lot of hacking on information, and think about all the threats to the information we have. Now, adding the Internet of Things and controlling things, think about the calamity that could be caused, the disasterness that could be caused if somebody hacks into, you know, affecting the temperature in your house overnight, or talking about medical devices. A co-worker of mine, actually a former boss, has a pacemaker type device, and he said how it's controlled, how it can be controlled by doctors. And that's scary, the lack of security in these devices, and how we're talking about human life. We're not just talking about lack of information or inconvenience. We're talking about human life. So cryptography is becoming more important. And I think one of the other things that not discussed in the presentation is a fail-safe. We have to have, you're able to control a variable that affects the security of, you know, being able to be secure. You got to have a fail-safe on that variable. And that value has to have a control that it can't go below the minimum or above the maximum, whatever that is, whatever you're more concerned about. So that can be secured through cryptography. Anything else you?
No, actually, Carol, one of the things that I worry about having in a nest and why putting another traditional thermostat in parallel is what happens when it fails. Mm-hmm. We had a good discussion about the car bus, an onboard card system. A graduate student I'm working with is looking at buying the little dongle that plugs into the EBC2 diagnostic port that opens up the full car bus to his Android tablet. And we're going to have a little bit of fun to see exactly what he can do. My understanding is there's no authentication between those buses on the car bus, which means you can basically own the car by plugging it in. The video showing what they did to the Cherokee in the parking lot, putting in the ditch, really, really emphasizes it. I've actually talked to the person that does. GM, up until quite recently, had no product security person. And when you think about it. So, I don't know, any questions? I know we've got some time.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. So, any questions?
Great presentation, thank you. Talked about the FDA, where nothing was there. You said you searched your site, couldn't find anything. My question is, why is that? And why does that persist? And is it like still where I work, or where I still work, large company, small, security not here, at the bottom of the list, constantly? Is it more important to have it in the middle, to have it pervasive in their minds, to able to get developers on board? What's the key here? Because it seems to me in every discussion we have, it's always at the bottom of the list, no matter what I say.
That's a phenomenal observation. And I have one of my daily fights is on the educational side is why we need to teach it. That's a fundamental question. My son did a university degree, a business degree at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario. He actually had a third-year course in information security. That's pretty impressive for a business program. We now have medical informatics starting as an option for physicians. It has no security. So part of the answer is it's not taught. For me to do a doctorate in information security, I couldn't do one in Canada. I had to go to the U.S. And that's the only reason that those school, my school existed, is because NSA made the investment to get people trained. So there's a fundamental lack of training, and also we have a perchance to want to trust. The other thing, and I'm going to turn over to Carol to get her reaction here in a couple of seconds, is I was one of the reasons I went to the University of Saskatchewan. The CIO 6 years ago started the fight to get someone at the director level to be able to drive it into the organization. It's taken 4 years. So that is, awareness is the big issue. And that I can talk to. So I'm going to turn it over to Carol to see if she has any observations.
I think the only thing I would add to that is there's a kind of a naivety that it's not me. I mean, it's like thinking about mortality. We don't want to think about it. So there's kind of a naivety, nobody's going to be interested in what I have to offer. Nobody's going to be interested in affecting my life. But, you know, as there's physical security threats, as there's terrorism threats to our lives, I think security becomes more and more front and center, and maybe we've got to think more about the security of our information as well as the security of our physical security when we go to events or when we're out in the public and there's a terrorism threat. Anything else?
Any other questions so far?
Thank you very much for your attendance and your comments.
So thank you, Lawrence, Carol. So we're a little bit ahead of schedule, and so maybe we wait a few minutes to give the participants the possibility to switch rooms.
Okay, why is it saying that?
The device is currently, maybe we have to close the Explorer.
Yeah.
Maybe he's blocking.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Oh, yes. So oh, yeah, I remember you now. Yeah, I remember you now.
Let me see where the other presentation is.
Here we go. It's hopefully.
You can now inject.
I'm not going to worry about it. If it corrupts the file, it corrupts the file.
Thank you.
But what I also don't see yet is industry standards pushing for it, right? So, like, you know, the people talk about it, non-OT, people talk about it in IoT, but there's no driving industry to say, okay, you have to have a cryptographic module inside that has these five functions or something like that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. There's no push from the manufacturers. They're trying to find any information on crypto and IoT devices.
Like that little compact flash company that makes it, right, with their cloud-based kit. They only recently turned on HTTPS. Oh, we're secure now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your email is available tomorrow and there.
Yeah, so it's very end. Here, I'll give you the card.
Sure, that'd be great. Thank you. Just send you a few
nice
things.
To see you.
Working for Telus right now.
Oh.
That will change shortly.
That's okay.
For 10 years, it's too
different. FDA has published some cybersecurity guidelines on how to acquire it yet.
Oh, I didn't realize that was out because I haven't. That must be recent.
It was last year.
Okay.
And it's not a requirement yet, but they're planning to do a more certain certification process.
Okay, that's good to know. I didn't. I know my contact at NIST was not aware of it, so that.
I spoke in 2 years ago. The FCC can tell you about the security requirements for medical devices that are wireless, and the FCC is eventually the FDA.
Yeah, well, I mean, it originally started in our vet college. We bought this thing that dispenses. Medications, primarily for horses, which will kill a human, right? And we scanned it, and we said, we actually put a firewall right in front of it.
But a lot of the
perimeter security.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what happened. Because we beat everything up on campus with Nessus every night. And, you know, it's... Yeah, well, I mean, and our problem is... Not a problem, I guess. Fun for me, in some sense. We're buying the latest and greatest technology. We get vendors cooperating with researchers. We want to go build this. We can deploy it here, right? We have a surgeon that's doing all this remote diagnostics and wants to do remote surgery. And I'm going, okay. But it's good to know. My last look at the medical file on these pain pumps was last fall, and that's when I did the literature check, and there was like, I'll go take a read of it. Is it reasonable?
It's pretty lightweight. It's not great. It's mostly osteoporosis and remining. The main emphasis is I'm trying to push the requirement onto the vendor. So historically, the manufacturers of devices are saying, hey, that's a hospital problem. Like, I give you a device, you got to put it on a secure network. It's not my issue if it's vulnerable to some attack.
See, what's happening in Saskatchewan, and it's through the Professional Engineering Association, we've got the doctors convinced that unless we sign off, they're not allowed to use it on their network. And you should see the reaction from the medical equipment vendors. What do you mean you have to have an engineer sign off? Sorry, to be employed, just like to use it here, we have...
Another problem with a lot of medical environments is you have two groups of an IT group that manages the following pipes. Then you have a group of people who actually manage the devices.
Yeah, medical electronics guys, yes.
So they do like calibration and settings and things like that. The two generally don't get along very well, so you wind up with some debate between the two.
Yeah, we have removed that because we make them report to the same service delivery AVP. That's in Saskatoon between our health region and the medical school. So there's a service delivery person that owns both directors. Well, all he has to do is put the two ladies together and kind of bang them and say. But you know, you're quite correct. Like, we're doing a lot of work on advanced diagnostics research. We walked in there and there was network cable all strung around. Because they didn't want to be on the network because it was too restrictive. And yeah, sorry.
Anyway, thank you
very much.
Yeah,
we enjoyed your presentation, by the way. Thank you.
Corruption. So it wasn't Lockheed Martin. It was General Dynamics.
Okay, sorry. I knew it was one of the big.
General Dynamics, and they never really used it a lot. So the kernel was called SCL4, done by OpenBio.
Yes, that's it.
So, because I reviewed the group, took a look at that.
Yeah, it was great work.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
When I was starting my doctorate, I was looking at doing some work on trusted hypervisors. Then I got the wrong defense contractor bought it, and then it just kind of disappeared.
We are coming built a secure hypervisor.
Yeah.
But yeah, just wanted to make sure so that.
So it wasn't the
state. It wasn't Lockheed Martin, it was General
Dynamics.
Okay. Hey, thank you.
Great presentation.
Okay.